Welcome back to the show. Hi there. This is John Fotheringham again. In today's episode, I talk to Mike Campbell, the founder of Glossika, and a friend of mine from back in my Taiwan days who I somehow haven't seen in 7 years. We catch up on all the innovations he's done at Glossika, his work to help save endangered languages, and how his views on applied linguistics and language acquisition have evolved since we last chatted. Enjoy the show. How you been? I can't believe it's been like 7 years since I've seen you.
Yeah, it's been a while, yeah.
Crazy. So I know you've talked about this on some of the other podcasts, but just for the sake of those that are new to you and to Glossika, I want to hear a bit about your, what I like to call your origin story. So if you were like if this were a comic book version of your life, how did you get into languages? What was that first experience, or was there any pivotal moment where you're like, oh my gosh, I love this stuff?
Well, yeah, I've always loved languages since I was a kid. So I was also a big fan of cartography as a child. Just the idea of like, you can put places down on a piece of paper and see the relation between them, like on a map. Mm. And that was just really fascinating. But since I grew up in Europe, so I heard languages. And so that just naturally led to this fascination with them. So
do you remember like any early time when it first clicked to you? Was it a particular language or an experience where it all kind of came together that you really realized I want to commit my life to learning languages? So is it more?
Yeah, I mean, I attended English speaking schools as a child in these international schools. But I remember there was some class early on where they taught us Latin and French. That's a very standard thing to do in Europe. I loved the Latin, but I hated the French. The funny thing was that I remember the French teacher actually taught us in a way that was quite unique in these days. Like he was actually trying to teach us like how to actually speak and understand the language rather than just memorize a bunch of vocabulary. And I hated it. I was just like, where's all the like grammar exercises? Because that's what we did in Latin class. And that was fun. It was like analyzing sentences and I really enjoyed it. And looking back on it, I think that I learned a lot of like just very easy stuff, like conversational stuff to say in French, but I ended up not liking it at all. And my Latin was just sort of like, I learned cases, I learned conjugations and declensions. That was a really good kind of foundation. And then I ended up just learning a bunch of stuff on my own. So I had some exposure to Spanish and Italian and German. Yeah, so a lot of exposure to the Western European languages, a little bit of Eastern European languages, Czech and Slovak, a little bit of exposure there. So yeah, I grew up around just being exposed to these languages.
So that's quite interesting that you had kind of an opposite experience, I think, from a lot of learners where they want to focus on listening and speaking and learning practical language, but hate the memorization and
I was like 7 or 8 years old,
and declension tables.
It was
things.
Like so that, primary school. So, and then we moved the next year and we didn't have it at the next school that I went to. So when you have it taken away from you, just like, what was all that cool stuff I was doing last year? And so by the age of like 10 or 11, this really grew into this big thing about like, I wanted to figure out languages because I had that early exposure in one school and then it was gone the next year, you know? So.
Yeah. Humans are more loss averse than we are interested in getting more. So from European languages, then fast forwarding to Mandarin and, you know, various Aboriginal languages, for lack of a better word, in Taiwan. What was that jump
yeah,
like?
Yeah, so I've spent pretty much my whole adult life living in Taiwan. And I originally came just because I wanted to experience living in a multilingual society where several of these languages actually overlap and see if I could acquire those languages. I wanted to experience, you know, what it's like to have the minority languages also spoken by majority of the population as well. So not to mention I've overstayed my visit, but there's quite a great wealth of indigenous languages to learn as well. So never ending.
Yeah. So for the listener's benefit, could you talk a little bit about that linguistic diversity? I think, I mean, most people know that they speak Mandarin in Taiwan as an official language, but there's a lot more going on there. Can you go into that a little bit?
I would say that 70% of the population are actually ethnically, they're from Fujian province, Hokkien speaking, or as we call it here, is Taiwanese. So most people have this sort of passive ability in Taiwanese, and then there's a good percentage of them actually speak it pretty well. And then you have a smaller group of people that are the Hakka, which is also a Chinese group. Now, they're kind of spread out all over Taiwan, so there's like six different major dialects, but there's a couple of major dialects in the north spoken by the majority of the people. And so even if you come to Taiwan, you're in the transportation system, you get on the, you know, the metro, you're going to hear all three of these languages actually spoken over the broadcast system. So they'll tell you, oh, your next stop is such and such a place, but they'll tell you in Mandarin, Taiwanese, and Hakka. So it's kind of interesting. The first time I arrived in Taiwan, I heard this at the train station. I was just, man, that is a weird sounding thing. Like, what is that last thing? And it took me years to figure out, oh, they're actually speaking Hakka. I just thought it was like a weird accent of Taiwanese or something else. I really had no idea what they were saying. And it does sound kind of really, really wacky. So, but I've gotten to the point where I can understand all three of them to varying degrees. And then the indigenous languages, these guys have been here for thousands of years. And so Taiwan is pretty much the Urheimat, or the homeland for the whole Austronesian language family. So to give, you know, a lot of your listeners are probably in the United States. If you've ever learned the language Hawaiian, or you know, like a few words of Hawaiian, like maybe you know the word mahalo, basically the Hawaiian word for thank you. The thing is that this word has an ancient history that was passed down through as they traveled around. Hawaii has only been inhabited for like less than 1,000 years. So the language is actually one of the newest languages in the whole language family. One of its closest relatives, you know, other than Fiji and Tahiti, is the language in New Zealand. So Samoa, Fiji, Tahiti, they're all related quite closely with Hawaiian. But one that's getting a lot of attention these days is Maori in New Zealand. And so their languages are very, very similar to each other. But Hawaiian is a very, very new version. And it lost a lot of things in the process. It lost a lot of sounds. So it's sort of a simplified version of these other languages. But their word for mahalo is actually still present in some Taiwanese languages. So these are languages that have been around for thousands of years. So the word in Saishiat is ma'alo. And the word in Paiwan with a P, that's in southern Taiwan, they say masalu. So masalu and ma'alo are two languages, two words for thank you in two of the Taiwanese languages, the same word that still exists. Yeah.
Wow. Have you done any research into not only the linguistic similarities, but any of the like genetic testing they've done to sort of correlate, you know, the patterns and the histories how those overlap?
I've gone on a Wikipedia and read up a little bit. There's something called a blood haplogroup, kind of like blood types, and these kind of correlate loosely with languages. And so, yeah, there's a lot of overlap where these things agree. The haplogroups between ethnicities and languages pretty much correlates. Yeah, but yeah, I wouldn't say I'm not an expert on the genetic part. Yeah.
Did you know this when you went to Taiwan? Was that part of what brought you there, or is that something you discovered after you arrived?
Well, you know, I kind of just hung around in the city for a long time before actually getting out to explore the rest of the island. And it always had bothered me in the back of my mind that there are indigenous and aborigine people. And I just felt like one day it just became very, very pressing for me to just get out and explore this side of Taiwan. So I think I was already here maybe 5 or 6 years, 7 years before I started to actually look into that. But I think that my other Chinese languages had already reached a point where I felt very comfortable just heading out. And I actually learned one of the Aborigine languages through Taiwanese. The elders don't even speak Mandarin. So I felt pretty comfortable with my ability at that point.
Right. Yeah, I think for those that aren't familiar with the linguistic history, I mean, Mandarin is very new to Taiwan, at least as a, you know, official language. I mean,
yeah. And the other thing is that a lot of when you go onto these websites and you want to find languages to learn, most of the time you're going to find like languages listed on there, like Japanese, Korean, and Chinese. Some of them will have Cantonese, but not many. And so like Cantonese learning resources are much lower. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of people, they get confused that about like what's the deal with Mandarin and Cantonese? Are these separate languages? But I mean, if you right. learn Mandarin, you're not going to understand a word of Cantonese at all. And so, I mean, it's just clear as day.
Right.
The only reason
right.
why people call them dialects is because they grew up being exposed to both languages. Like people in southern China, when you grow up and you're exposed to both of them, they switch between them all the time, like they're dialects. So it's something very natural that they learn. And so the same thing mm-hmm. here in Taiwan, people are just going to call them dialects. But actually, Southern Min is as different to Mandarin as Russian is to English. They only have like 20,
right.
some 25% lexical similarity between them. And although the grammar is mostly the same, there's still some different word orders, but there's still a lot of different uses mm-hmm. of verbs and how verbs connect with objects in those two languages. So there's still a lot of grammatical difference too.
Yeah, no, the language dialect debate is an interesting one, but it's an endless one because I know you've talked about this before as well. There really is no clear-cut distinction, and it often comes down to either political or emotional, you know, definitions and differences. So if people haven't heard it, there's that great joke that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. I think that's pretty funny. So what did you do? Like what was the actual process? And would you do it the same now, knowing what you know now about language learning?
You know, I signed up for classes and I didn't get very, very far with that. I felt like something's missing. So I basically just took it into my own hands. And so, yeah, I mean, I've talked about this extensively in other places, but it's just basically I developed my own methods to reach fluency. One thing that I did actually was everything that I learned on a day-to-day basis, I would go home and look it up in the dictionary. And so I got really good with using a Chinese dictionary. I got really good with just learning the characters for every word that I'd learned that day. And if I couldn't find them, figure them out, I would ask somebody the next time I met with them. So I'd try to keep the writing up as I moved along. So reading and writing, yeah.
So I know that part of Glossika, a big focus is on learning through listening and not through reading and writing. Can you go into a bit about why that's important or how that is potentially more effective, especially in the beginning, than a more lexical approach that a lot of people seem to take?
I have learned quite a few more complex European languages that have, well, I would say they're complex in the sense that the grammars have a lot of declensions and conjugations. And so the thing is with that is, you know, even with a language like Spanish, you're going to end up with a myriad of conjugational issues that you have to learn. And so it's challenging when the student has to think about which conjugation, verb tense or whatnot to use, it slows them down. But when you've heard something used in sentences in a specific way, when it's paired together with adverbs of time or frequency, or a period of time, then it's quite easy to actually just switch to the verb you want because you've heard it in that context so many times. So, yeah, I mean, there's different issues for different European languages, but even with Asian languages, you're going to have the situation where you need to use completely different verbs depending on whether it takes an object or not. So, you know, there's what we call intransitive or transitive. And so like in a language in like Korean or Japanese, these right. might actually take different particles on the nouns that are agreeing with the verb. So all these kinds of things, they play into it. So if you're having to think about it, it's just too much work. But if you're actually doing it through the audio training, it becomes something that it's like a song. You know, you don't learn how to sing with mm-hmm. with well, I guess professional singers do, maybe in opera, but we don't learn how to sing our pop songs from the musical page. You know, we're not reading sheet music to sing. We listen to the song. You know, when I was a kid, it was the radio. I don't know what people do now, but you listen to the song on the radio and you sing along, you know.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. And then, you know, you hear one word or one stanza and you automatically know what's coming next. And to your point, you can do the same thing with collocations in a language.
Like, yeah, so I mean, you could hear the first word or a couple words of a song now that you knew from when you were a kid, and you can probably say the rest of the, you know, the lyrics for the whole song. You know what's going to come next. You know what the next word is. So languages are kind of like, they're kind of like songs, right? You know, you get right. used to how things go together, and it has this sing-songing quality where some things just don't go together because nobody's ever said it that way. No native speaker has ever said that. And so what a language learner often does as a mistake is they'll say something that a native speaker has never said or ever heard before, and they just look at you really weird.
Right. Yeah. Because they're translating directly from their own language.
Yes.
Word by word is usually why, I think.
So those are some common mistakes that new language learners make.
Yeah. What are some more? Now that on that topic, it's one of my favorites, because I know I've made a mountain of mistakes earlier on and still continue to do so.
Well, the thing is that, like, English is made up of so many slang or multi-word expressions. So, and a lot of it's not necessarily slang. It's just the way we speak. It's the way we use the language. So it's a big mistake to assume that the words you're using are actually literally put in that order. So you can't translate. You can't translate any. In fact, I would say that, I was just talking to Richard Simcott the other day, and there was one example. He said, like, I'll take you out. You know, if you translate that literally into Spanish, that becomes, I'm going to remove you from a container. So taking you out is kind of like removing you from a container called your house. You know, we're going to go out on a date or something, but that's not the verb that you want to use.
But it could also mean kill you. So that's important.
Yeah, like the assassin took him out. Yeah, so you can't just translate that. You can't just use the word take and out in another language. You're not going to convey that meaning. So, right. And another example is to put off. It has nothing to do with placing or putting. And so to assume that you'd use it in another language to describe a delay or a procrastination would be a major error. So students need to learn how to get really good at using synonyms in their own language. So what I would like to ask a student is, can you swap any word in your sentence in your own language with an easier or harder word? Can you derive the deep and accurate meaning of what you're trying to convey? So every student has to practice doing this kind of what we call deep semantics of whatever they're trying to say in their own language. And once they can do this, then they'll be able to express themselves with the right choice of words in the foreign language. And so glossika uses sentences in translation to show you how things get expressed differently. But at the same time, we always try to translate from this deep semantics. So with languages like Chinese and English, they're actually surprisingly very similar languages, expression, but you still have to.
Right. That was my first.
You still have to dig for what is the deep meaning of what you're trying to explain, and then translate from that, because you're going to end up with a different set of words. So this is, you know, translation is a skill that we all need to know as language learners, so that we're able to, we don't fall into the traps of saying things what comes naturally to you as an English speaker, and the choice of words that you're using just won't work in another language. So you have to learn how to think at this deep semantic level, and then learn how to rebuild those concepts into the language you're speaking. Now, with European languages, there's very little of that you have to do. I've noticed that a lot of translators for European languages, they don't it's not necessary for them to go to deep semantics. And so you'll actually end up with a lot of translation errors because they have not practiced this enough. So some things will just trip them up because they're not required to do too much deep semantics. Because most European languages, they translate pretty straightforward between each other.
Yeah, so they kind of rest on their laurels maybe a little bit too much.
Right. Now, some languages like German and Dutch, they have absolutely crazy word orders. But, you know, I'm not talking about word order. I'm just talking about, like, the actual use of vocabulary and words, prepositional prepositional verb phrases and things like this. Prepositions are different in every language. Their usage is completely different.
Right.
But you can still, you know, you're going to have a preposition in one language. You're going to have one in another language almost always.
Might be a postposition, but it's still some kind of particle or something, yeah, attached to a noun. Yeah.
Right. So Chinese uses, in addition to prepositions, they have something called like a circumposition. It goes before and after a word. So I can say, I would say at the table on, 在桌子上, or I would say at the road on, 在路上, and so it means I'm on the road or, you know, I'm on the table. So,
yeah. And that was one of those things that tripped me up, definitely, when I started in Mandarin, because it was that is one of those things that is different.
But the Chinese word zai is an amazing word because it just means at, on. It just answers where for anything. So you have fewer prepositions in Mandarin, makes it super easy to learn. And then you can just add the actual location after the noun that you're saying. So you kind of learn how to express things in a different way. Yeah. Part of that discussion I had with Richard, or I was following up with something he wrote, was that, yeah, basically I like to argue that the only reason why Google Translate, and we've all used it, right, it fails to translate correctly, usually is not because of its own failure. It's rather the failure of the person who wrote or spoke the sentence to speak clearly and unambiguously. So most of what we say in colloquial speech, which is what Google Translate fails at the most, it's ambiguous. It's a massively lossy format.
Right.
So other languages have various degrees of this lossy format, or maybe none at all. So some languages might translate really easily, or depending on the sentence. But we as language learners, we also need to learn how to rethink what we're saying so that we convey that meaning accurate in our target language. And then also if you, for example, that sentence, I'll take you out, if you actually write that more clearly, Google Translate would actually translate it better for you. It's just that we leave a lot unsaid when we speak. So another problem that students face when they're learning new languages is this whole concept of subjects and objects. So English always likes to put something in the subject position before the verb. And it doesn't matter whether that thing actually did anything or not.
Right. Could be an it rained, but it's still an it there. Yep.
Yeah. For example, I can say an accident just happened. So an accident didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. What happened was an accident appeared. Mm-hmm. It came out of nowhere. It now exists, right? So before it was not there, and now it is there. It happened. But the accident didn't do anything. So it's not really the thing that did this verb happen. It's like the heavens happened this accident, you know. So even though Chinese is an SVO language, or is the same word order as English, subject, verb, object, the accident follows the verb in Chinese. But it's not the actual object of the verb. So in linguistics, we call this a theme. It's neither a subject, it's neither an object, it's not an agent, it's not a patient, it's a theme. So because it didn't do or undergo any action. So when we say the accident happened, it came into being. So happen is actually an existential verb. It's just like the verb like become or be. And so Russian is actually an interesting case because just like English and Chinese, it's also an SVO language, but its word order is the same as Chinese. So in Chinese, we would say, 发生了车祸. I would say happened an accident. And then in Chinese, in Russian, you say произошло авария. So again, slowly, that's произошло авария. So авария is the word for I think there's another language that uses the word avaria. You might recognize it. Maybe it's French or something, but avaria is, just means an accident. If you know a little bit of Russian, you'll notice that the word avaria, it ends with an a sound, and an a can only be a nominative case. It's only a subject. It's never with an a in the object case, unless it's a person.
Have you studied on this topic, if I'm interesting, are you familiar with sort of the topic comment distinction in Japanese? And is that...
Yeah, that is actually...
Related to this in any way?
We can define everything through basically the roles that every noun plays in the syntax. And so that will actually define whether you're getting a wa or a ga marker in there. So that also has to do with the transitivity of the verb, which means does the verb take an object or not? Or is the topic that you're speaking about is just a theme? It didn't actually undertake the action of the verb.
Right. You're introducing a new context, basically. Yeah.
So when you look at things that happen in the real world and you analyze it, you look at the event and you the way that you say it in English is you're just like saying the noun first and then you say the verb. So you can say the door closed. Well, the door didn't close on its own unless the world tipped over and gravity moved it. You know, the wind pushed it closed or a person closed it or, you know, something took an action on that door in order for the door to close. But in English, we're always just going to say the door closed. But you're not going to say it like that in Japanese. You're going to have to mark it accordingly.
Or you need an exorcist in your house if the door closed.
Yeah, it depends. You know, I don't know about where you live.
So going back to Mandarin a little bit, I've met a lot of Mandarin speakers. I've learned for a number of years, but you probably have the best of any non-native speaker that I've met. So obviously, I mean, you've spent a lot of time on it. That's a big component here. But what are some of the things that you did that brought you to that level where you think other learners maybe have not done?
Yeah, there's probably two parts that I can talk about here. One is what I focused on, and then I can kind of lead into pronunciation issues, like tones and all that, because those are obviously stumbling blocks. And I'm no saint or gifted savant to doing this either. So it's,
which is important, I think, because that's what a lot of people will assume is that, oh, you're just good at languages.
I think we're all born pretty much equal in this regard. We have one native language, two if we're lucky, but it always takes a lot of work. And those of us who are dedicated to it, like myself, we try to figure out how do we trick the brain into actually learning this stuff, because we want to be able to help people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about like, oh, I'm just amazing at this and look at me. No, it's like I'm actually trying to figure out how the brain works and how we can help people. Mm-hmm. So because we go through all the same challenges. So in the beginning, when I started Mandarin, I boosted my knowledge of the language by doing lots of translations and lots of reading. So in addition to just going out and listening to the language every day, I would, you know, try to start with some beginner materials, like just stories and stuff. Not beginners. I'm talking about like maybe kids' books, you know, things like this. But I would have to say that my fluency in the language is really because of what I did for my pronunciation. And so when people come to Glossika, I think that one of the things they struggle with is that Glossika doesn't actually help them at all with pronunciation, but maybe they're just looking at it wrong, because I think that this is actually one of our strongest points, is that you really have to be aware. You really have to learn how to be aware of what you're doing, rather than having a teacher or somebody or a tutor always telling you what your mistakes are. Because when you're a kid in a foreign country in the classroom and all the other kids are laughing at you, the way you sound or the way you speak, because you can't speak their language yet, it forces you to change yourself quickly because of the peer pressure. Your teacher's never going to laugh at you. But if you ask your teacher to laugh at you every time you say it wrong, you're going to get real nervous. You're going to start like changing how you speak. So I think the fact that our teachers don't laugh at us is actually to our own detriment. So that was a little bit of a side note there, but.
So yeah, there you go, language teachers. Yeah, Mike Campbell, quote, laugh at your students.
Yeah, your student's going to hate you, but they'll actually end up performing really well. So there's something we don't do as adults, but kids are always laughed at you. So I remember, like, I would try to speak Chinese to these kids, and they would always laugh at me. And I just, what did I say wrong? And I would ask them, and they'd say, no, you don't say it like that. You say it like this. And I said, oh, okay. Kids are great. Mm. They help you actually learn the language. I mean, they're not laughing at you. Mm. They're laughing at what you said because it just sounds hilarious. You know, but they actually kind of like, but they also like you because they think you're humorous. but when I was first starting, I had to listen to native speakers and mimic them as much as I could. So, because I had a lot of trouble with the pronunciation of Mandarin. And I think everybody is going to have a lot of trouble with it. So what I found was that the IPA, the International Phonetic Alphabet, helped me immensely. Mm-hmm. One of the other problems was linking the sounds together, linking words together with sounds that I couldn't even put together. Like, to mention something a little bit technical here, there's retroflex sounds with your tongue in a weird position following something where you're using the tip of your tongue in the front of your mouth. So like you might say, and then sh, and then, or tr, and then it's, and I'm like, what, how the heck is my mouth supposed to go from this one sound to the next sound? I couldn't figure it out. And people are speaking so fast. And so I started to notice that native speakers made shortcuts in their pronunciation, and they would change that previous sound in order to hit the next sound. And they could still maintain the speed at which they talked. So one of my problems was that I was just not being able to speak at the right speed. So a really simple example, not of the retroflex, but of a pronoun. If anybody has ever studied Chinese, you'll have already learned this word. The pronoun is the word for he or she, and it's ta. The pronoun ta changes its pronunciation in almost every sentence, if you pay attention. So it loses the T sound, but it keeps the aspiration. It keeps the H. So the T becomes an H whenever it's the object of a verb. So, for example, if I say speak to him, 跟他讲, I'm not saying 跟他讲, I'm 跟他讲. So it becomes a weakened T, but actually the T disappears. So, you know, I could say, I'm going to tell you something. 我跟你讲, 我跟他讲. But if I say, give him the book, 把书给他, it just becomes a really, really weak T. So this is one example of like millions of words, not millions, but thousands of words where this sound change happens. And so when you start, this is called an allophone. So an allophone helps you speak more like a native speaker. And so the IPA can show us what's happening on the surface. The thing is, like, when you learn Chinese, you have to learn, okay, the third tone becomes a second tone in these positions. But when you look in a dictionary, it's never going to tell you that this tone changes here. This is just a rule you have to know. But how many more rules are there in the language that you haven't learned yet? It's probably a lot. So Mandarin speakers would keep the ta, for emphasis, in much the same way that we switch our English pronunciation to a phonemic pronunciation in order to emphasize. So I might be saying the word little, or I might be saying better, but when I want to emphasize the word, I might say better or little. I'm going to pronounce that T, you know, but...
You sound like John Malkovich when you do that.
Yeah, but when I... When I'm not emphasizing it, I'm not saying little or better. I'm saying little or better. You know, the T changes. So long story short, by learning the allophones, you sound more native. And so if you hear somebody speaking English and they're saying better all the time, you just like, it grates on your ear, on your ears, you know. And you kind of want to tell that person, hey, you know, relax your sounds a little bit. You'd sound a lot easier to listen to. And if you can't figure out the allophones for yourself, then you can get an IPA transcription of whatever you're working on. And that's exactly what we provide in Glossika. So,
Which is very cool, by the way. Yeah.
It's in written form, but it's if you learn, you know, you don't have to learn it. You just kind of listen to what you're listening to and look at the sounds that are there and you'll figure it out.
Yeah. And you don't have to learn it for every language in the world. You learn it for whatever language you're learning. And so the number of symbols is much reduced.
There's basically less than 100 IPA symbols that are used in 99% of the languages out there. So it's the every language have the right. same sounds. They just have a different subset of these like 100 or so symbols.
Like I've never learned the IPA for clicks because I don't speak any click languages yet. So I haven't looked at those.
But mimicking the way of speaking and adjusting for different speeds and those different allophones, that helped me sound more native. I was able to speak faster, get my tones to match right, and tones they don't mm-hmm. sound like what they sound like in the book. You have to adjust to right. how they sound like in the sentence. And you're kind of like just jumping back and forth. It just feels like jumping, you know, like I'm jumping up and down. But you get to the point where it just boom, boom, boom. It just comes out.
Becomes intuitive. Yeah. Yeah. I remember, I don't remember where, who I heard it from, but they might have been you to stop trying to think about each character or syllable's tone. Like stop thinking this is a third tone and this is a fourth tone. Hear an entire phrase or sentence and then just try to mimic that entire phrase and sentence. And that changed my entire life. I mean, that made it so much easier to understand and to be understood and to stop overpronouncing every single syllable. So that's huge for tones. How about for characters? Because that's another pretty common stumbling block. People see these, you know, this pile of strokes and noise, and it can be really overwhelming in the beginning. I actually think if you go about it in a more adult-friendly way, I think characters can actually be a lot of fun. It can be one of the easier parts of the language in a way. But that's my opinion. What do you recommend for people to, if they want to be fully literate in Mandarin or in Japanese or any other, you know, ideographic language?
So the first thing is that English speakers are at a major disadvantage. And I don't want to kind of blow your minds, but to tell you the truth, guys, the English language sucks in so many ways that if you don't speak other languages, you just don't know how much it sucks. Here's the thing, is that all of our roots in the English language, you have no idea what they are.
Right.
Like, for example, if I ask you what's the root for the word grasp, you have no idea. If I ask you what's the root for the word carpet, you have no idea. Yeah. It's actually related to the word cover, you know, but... So the problem here is that the idea of roots in English are so opaque that English speakers generally have no, in fact, English speakers at a major disadvantage because we're still using dictionaries when you get to university level and high school level. Like no other language in the world is like that. People just aren't, they don't need dictionaries to reach when they get to the higher levels of education, because all of the words already make sense before they get there. They already know the structure of all their words. I've never seen a Chinese person ever use a dictionary past elementary school.
That's a really interesting point.
And if you can get that into your, there's no such thing as a college dictionary in China or in Russia. You know, if you can get that into your head and really understand that concept, then you'll understand how much of a disadvantage you are at knowing English. So when you look at a language like Russian, what you'll notice is that in spite of the words being really, really long, you can actually break it down into all of its components, and it works just like Latin. Every little letter in the Latin word or in the Russian word or Slavic word, they consist of a specific meaning. And when you put them together, they have a constructive meaning that means something useful, and they're based on the roots. And they're completely hidden in English. You just have no idea like where these words came from. It's really English is just a big mess of words. We rely so much on lexicalization, which means that, okay, this group of sounds that are arbitrary and I'm just going to memorize them as a word that I can use. But in most languages, that's not how languages work. They're actually built up from basic structures. Mm-hmm. And so with Chinese, it's the same. Every character has this long history and it has a meaning tied to it. Mm-hmm. But when you put it together in another word, now there's a few exceptions where they don't make sense, but every single character has a general meaning or a root. And just like Russian, you'll have words that are long that could be 3, 4, 5, or 6 Chinese characters long. But have some sort of big compound meaning. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is that Chinese becomes really, really easy to learn if you learn some of the common roots, the common these common characters that show up in lots and lots of words. But when you learn new words, you just realize, oh, they say it like this. Mm-hmm. You know, what's a good example? Like, okay, so the word for carpet is ditan. It's something spread out on the ground.
On Earth,
It's a ground spread.
Yeah.
Is what and you'll find that in a lot of other languages. Okay, so the word for computer in Chinese is diannao, electric brain.
Right.
And you'll find in a lot of other languages that they construct their words in very similar ways. So yeah. it's once you realize that, you'll find that learning vocabulary in foreign languages can be extremely quick and easy. But you have to kind of break through to that point. Learn the characters as you go,
right.
But you need to learn vocabulary, which is not just single characters. Mm-hmm. Single characters do not represent vocabulary. Single characters are just roots. They're the history, the root of the word inside of another word.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point for people that have not learned Chinese yet. People probably think that a character is a word, or even worse, that a character is a pictograph, which, yes, there's a very, very small number that are pictographs, but most are a combination of some meaning structure and then some phonetic structure.
Yeah, you know.
Which is another cool part about it, I think, is if you then learn, okay, this chunk of this character usually is pronounced like this or something like this. You can often guess, even if you've never seen a character before, okay, this is probably pronounced in one of three ways, and you'll be right, you know, 80 or 90% of the time, which is amazing.
Right. But if you already speak the language, then you're learning the characters when you already know that pronunciation.
Right.
So you don't even have to guess it. It just matches something that you already know how to say. So I would recommend people to do it the other way around. You already know how to use this word in speech. And then when you see the character, you just see there's a component that matches the sound that you already know. You're
right.
Like, oh, that's easy to remember because I already know that word.
Right.
And how to pronounce it. I just have to remember, oh, it has a different radical. That's all. Yeah.
Yeah, you have something to attach it to in your brain.
Like the word drawn, mm-hmm. and drawn and chuan. Chuan has a person radical and has a ch beginning, so chuan. So if I say I'm going to convey or send something to you, I can chuan guo qu. And then when I see the word, oh, it has a person radical. Oh, it is pronounced chuan, but it's not drawn. Oh, okay. Like drawn is a profession, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So those two words have the same part on the right side.
That's cool stuff. You know, going back to be able to guess at a word's meaning, the example I love using in both Mandarin and in Japanese is the word for homonym, you know, which is ask a junior high school student in English, you know, what's a homonym? You're going to get glazed over eyes. But you show that word to a Taiwanese or Japanese junior high school student. And even if they've never seen the word, they'll be able to look at each character and go, oh, same sound, different meaning word. You know,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, it's really cool.
The other thing is, like, when I learned medical vocabulary in Chinese, it was basically no effort at all. In fact, I can, other than words like ulcer, wei kui yang. But what does wei kui yang mean? It means stomach itch. You know, you're like, oh, stomach itch is ulcer. Oh, I don't even have to understand what ulcer means because the Chinese, sometimes I don't understand a word in English. I just look in the Chinese dictionary and it'll tell me the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I'll understand the word and its meaning just by translating it into Chinese because or other languages. That's how crazy stupid English is. When you say the word ulcer, you have no idea what a freaking ulcer is.
Yeah.
You don't even know what that means the first time you hear it.
Yeah.
But Chinese will tell you this is a stomach itchy, you know, kind of like a disease or problem. You know, you're like, oh, I know what that means. Like every kid can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
How many 10-year-old kids will tell you what an ulcer means?
Right.
Nobody. Right. So that's the great thing about Chinese. And of course, a lot of our medical words come from Greek. So
mm-hmm.
you can ask any kid in Greece, what's this word mean? And he'll tell you, like, what's an otorhinolaryngologist? He's like, oh, that's the doctor for the ear, nose, and throat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did you know that? because otorhinolaryngology means ear, nose, and throat. Right. That's exactly how you say it in Chinese. Or behold, you should just say ear, nose, throat, doctor. Mm-hmm. Like there is no challenge to understanding any of this because they say exactly what it is. So yeah, that's the thing about other languages, that the extreme disadvantage that we're at with English.
Yeah, I guess the one saving grace for us native English speakers is that it has become the default lingua franca, for now at least, worldwide. Yeah, yeah. Or I guess it should be lingua anglais, rather. So going back to mistakes that learners make in general or with learning Chinese specifically, or Mandarin, what are some other things that, other missteps you've seen people do or things maybe you did that you would do differently now in learning?
Well, I think this is kind of like language in general. The other things I would say, and also I can add in something about like indigenous languages. So first thing I would say is that this whole concept that languages encapsulate culture, or is it that culture encapsulates languages? I just really wish people would separate culture from language, because there's two different things here, and I'll talk about that. But the other thing is that there's no such thing as a primitive language.
Thank you.
So anything that you say that you're capable of thinking and saying and expressing, anybody in the Papua New Guinean forest or the Amazon forest can say those things in their own language. I mean, we all are human. We all share the same human experience. So, but to get back to what I said just now, culture and language, I think it's, people aren't necessarily doing this on purpose, but it's a racist attitude to think that someone else's language and expression is so vastly different because their culture is so vastly different. Ways of life can differ to some degree. Like, okay, some guys, they like to take showers in the morning. Other guys like to take showers in the evening, you know, like, wow, is that really a different way of life? We're all humans, right? We all live on, we're all from Earth, right? We're not from Mars. We all have the same grass, dirt, trees, oceans in our daily lives. So we all experience the same wide range of emotions in the whole human experience. We experience the same fears and the same angers and the same, you know, everything. People argue that, and I hear this a lot, people argue that there are certain things that you can't or shouldn't say in another culture. That's just being polite. What I would say is that every society has different degrees of being polite. And so if you worry about saying something wrong in another culture, all you just have to remember is just be polite. You know, just don't say stuff that you wouldn't even consider, that you would consider maybe is impolite or imposing. So from the point of view of someone who studied languages from all over the world, like myself, I would say that European languages are so similar to each other. They're almost like borderline dialects of each other. And to exaggerate their differences, or because it's due to culture, or, I mean, you're just pushing it. And I would say that if you're interested in looking into this further, go read some interesting books. I would recommend this guy called Jared Diamond.
Oh, yeah.
He's kind of like anthropology, historical stuff, humanity and history. But he spent a lot of time in Papua New Guinea. He spent a lot of time around the world, speaks many languages himself, including German. And he spent time in a lot of traditional societies. And he understands how the difference between, you know, like modern societies, obesity, how our health is, and cancer, how it's afflicting us and how it doesn't happen to traditional societies, and what's their different ways of living and all that. So it's really good. But yeah, I would say that culture limits our expression, especially in a lot of the Pacific and Australian languages, and also like in traditional Malagas, spoken in Madagascar. But that doesn't mean that the language doesn't have the capacity to say the full realm of human expression. So you can start worrying more about the cultural details once you've arrived at, let's say, a B1 level of speaking, because that's the point when you're actually reaching adolescence in this language. And I would say that most children, they can't speak at a B1 level, you know. So, you know, worry about that once you get to that level. You need to learn, you know, just stop worrying about culture. And culture can be fun, you know. Every culture has their festivities and national holidays and things like this. But I would say that doesn't really play a big role in the language itself.
Yeah. You know, came to mind just now, with Japanese specifically, you know, people often will say, "That's such a vague language." And I will always shoot back and say, no, Japanese is not a vague language. Japanese culture requires being vague a lot of time to not be rude. But it's not that they don't know exactly what they're saying.
It's a level of politeness.
Exactly. Yeah. When somebody says, if they ask an opinion and they will reply, oh, chotto, which literally just means a little, dot, dot, dot. They won't say it's a little what, because they are trying to be polite. They're just giving you a clue that they don't want to have to say that they're not happy with something. it's their accepted out of rudeness. But everybody, at least native speaker wise or fluent speakers, everyone in that context knows exactly what's being said, even though it's not being explicitly stated. And so, just to reiterate, you're saying, I assume that there are things like that in every world language.
And so what I've found as well from like the indigenous languages, and just to give your audience kind of one last thing here, is that when you're starting to learn another language, focus more on the verbs. And verbs may be intimidating. Mm. It might be hard to remember. They got a lot of changes. But seriously, forget about all your nouns. You have word lists. Just remove all your nouns. I want you guys to focus on your, you need some common nouns, like maybe chair and table and, you know, street and car. And, you know, you need a few places that you can talk about, like work, home, and school. But I would say
coffee, beer, you know, the essentials.
Yeah, keep your essential. You don't need to learn, like, when you're starting a language, of course, you're going to learn this later. You need to learn how to express more varieties of meaning later. But when you're first starting a language, get rid of all your noun lists. Mm. And just focus on your verbs and adjectives, because this is where the magic happens.
Right.
The thing is that English, when you look at the English language, you cannot see which word is a verb. But this is not true in especially European languages. Every single word that you see in the sentence, it actually has something attached to it that shows you that this is a verb.
Right.
You know, like there's actually verb, the infinitive of every European language it actually shows you it's an infinitive.
Right.
Some of them have simplified, like English. Like I would say maybe Danish and Swedish are now like that. But for the most part, verbs are very easy to recognize. And then you learn how to attach your nouns to those verbs, whether it's subject or object and whatnot. So, and verbs are amazing because it's so easy to produce so many new shades of meaning by changing the verb structure. So, for example, in Russian, I can just add, in the middle of the verb, I can add the two letters NU, which is pronounced NU, into the middle of a Russian verb to make that verb sound like it was an immediate action that just finished. Hmm. Isn't that cool?
So it's an infix. That's
yeah. So I could say,
wow, okay.
I might be looking at you. I might say, I would use it's the same root as English, glance, gladzit, or something like this. And then I can change it to glanut, like I glanced at you just for a second.
Okay.
You know, so something like this. I'm not sure if I said that right, but it's kind of the general idea. The in Russian, you have this ability to change the internal structure of the verb to change your nuances of meaning. And this is really fascinating. So verbs are where human communication happens the most. So if you want to learn how to speak with friends and colleagues and all of this, focus on your verbs. Mm. Of course, there are always going to be there's a million things in our lives. There's a million words for everything that we have around us in our daily life. And just take it as you learn them as they come up. Mm-hmm. And I would just say that make language kind of fun and be able to make use of it as soon as you can. But you spend more time and effort on the verbs and the roots and the prefixes and suffixes that go into those verbs.
That's a good tip. And it's a great creative constraint too, when you're just beginning and you feel overwhelmed by the, you know, 10,000 words you need to reach to get, you know, to a decent level of fluency. That's a great constraint.
Like seriously, I think everybody should have 1,000 verbs instead of 1,000 nouns. I mean, you can literally speak everything you want to speak with 100 nouns and 1,000 verbs. Mm-hmm. But with 1,000 verbs, you're going to be much stronger. Super much stronger than having 1,000 nouns. Yeah. You say a noun, nobody knows what you're saying. If you say, you know, if you say bus station, like they're like, what about it?
Right.
If you say, I want to go, they're like, oh really? Where do you want to go?
Right.
At that place that has, you know,
then you can draw a picture.
The buses, you know, the bus, but you understand? I want to go. You know, if you can say the verb, then they'll know what you want. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. I have never heard that tip. That is a good one.
Like, I don't speak Indonesian, but I can definitely say "Saya mau pergi." I want to go. Saya mau pergi.
Yeah, and when I was in Bangladesh, that's basically all I learned. I had like 5 verbs and directions. That was about to begin with, which was 500% more than most of my English speaking colleagues. So, yeah,
cool.
Very cool. So you were going to go down a little tangent on some of the minority languages and how maybe learning those may differ in some ways from learning more like national languages. Obviously, you know, finding resources is probably a big part of that.
Well, I think, okay, so I don't think many people are really interested in like actually learning the languages. And what I did for Glossika was just basically testing out my theories on whether I could pick up languages that hadn't been, you know, there just weren't resources available. I just want to test my methodology.
Or aren't written at all, I imagine. But some I think of what more people are, only.
Yeah, what more people are actually interested right now is like, what's this? What's going on with languages? Are they dying?
Mm-hmm.
So, do we have to help preserve and revive languages? And for the most part, most people don't care. You know, it's just like we're worried about endangered flora and fauna, though. These are not things that we typically think about from day to day. We don't want the rest of the frogs and the rhinos to go extinct, but it's not something that comes to mind on a daily basis, right? Mm-hmm. But there are ways that people can get involved to help save languages. I just recently published a report called the Glossika World Language Vitality Report. And this report goes into the vitality of each language on Earth. It's like, I have over 8,000 languages in the report, but it includes a lot of extinct languages. So it shows the language color, the language color coded. So by that color code, you can actually see if this language is, if it's near red or if it's near purple or blue, you know, like how healthy it is.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've been hearing in the media so much recently is that a language dies every 2 weeks. For the most part, I think that what they're trying to say is they're trying to predict the future because that hasn't happened yet. What languages died 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, 2 years ago? Name one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what I found is that between 2011 and 2018, we've had 2 languages go extinct. Well, let me repeat that. That's over a period of 7 years. We've had 2 languages go extinct, guys. And the media is reporting that a language dies every 2 weeks. Hello?
Yeah. And now, just to be clear for listeners, for a language to go extinct, that means that all native speakers of that language are no longer
alive. So let me go into more detail here. So 8 languages have become dormant. So I have a total list of 11 languages that have supposedly died. But 2 of them are extinct. 8 of them are dormant, including one that I speak from here in Taiwan. And one of those languages is currently in revitalization. It's a language spoken in the U.S. So, but including the one that I speak, that would actually make 2. The thing is that the International Standards Organization, ISO, they don't know about it because they don't read the reports written in Chinese.
Right.
They only read the reports written in English.
Right.
There's a lot of revitalization efforts happening around the world. Go on to my YouTube channel. I've got a video talking about it. So, but what we're doing at Glossika is we're also putting together a platform so you can also put your if you speak a minority language, you can put your language onto Glossika. We're adding a lot of additional tools so that you can process and output different kinds of data. But once that gets onto the site, then major languages like English and Chinese will also be available to learn directly from those minority languages, which empowers the people. You know, like they might speak some small African language, but now they can learn Chinese directly from their own language.
Mm.
And so the end goal is really to be able to learn things bilingually. Not just limited to learning languages, but or the sentences that we currently have on Glossika. I think that, you know, our plans is really to expand this immensely and take every language really, really deep so that we're covering all of the levels from A1 to C2 quite extensively.
And so just for those that aren't familiar with Glossika, so they have a better context of how this is working, it's basically based on sentences. And so in each language, then you're pairing the equivalent, as you would say, deep semantic meaning of each phrase or sentence. Is that
right?
An accurate description?
Yeah. I mean, Glossika is based off of something that I developed called Glossika Mass Sentence Method. And the reason why that's more effective than isolated vocabulary is because you're getting vocabulary in the context of a sentence. Just like we were mentioning earlier before, if you say, I take you out, you know, the assassin took him out, then you'll know that that specific sentence means that he killed him. Whereas you took your girlfriend out does not mean that you killed her. So learning things in context really helps you understand how the language uses those words. So we use something called space repetition, mm-hmm. and it's our own version of space repetition. I mean,
yeah, tell me a bit how that's different.
It's glossic of space repetition. There's two. Basically, we've defined a different kind of space repetition in the world. All the other space repetitions out there, they focus on memorization and reminding you when you're about to forget something. So that might be 2 weeks later, they'll remind you. Right. But instead, with our system, no memorization is involved. We don't want you to memorize anything. We want you to practice sentences, say them fluently. And by doing that, your memory will be triggered just like a song lyrics. Mm-hmm. You'll be triggered with how those words go together. You'll remember words better because you're practicing them in context.
It's more, you're focusing more on developing what's called like unconscious competence, whereas I think most flashcards focus on conscious competence.
Want you to think about it. Yeah. We want you to be able to recall the word naturally in speech, attached with the right grammar and all that, you know?
Right.
So the second thing is, instead of reminding you of a word through space repetition, like at the 2 week barrier when you're about to forget it, we don't do that. We focus on mastery. And I know you love that word, but
I do.
We focus on mastery up front. And what that means is that we time the space repetition with your brain sequences and how the brain consolidates your memories through sleep patterns, which means, put this simply, is that every day, I think everybody on Earth goes to sleep every day, right? Every 24 hours, we have a one sleep session. So if you come back to Glossika and do another session every single day, the program is set up so that it reviews and trains you for the words and the sentences you just learned yesterday. And once you do that 4 to 5 days in a row, you've reached mastery of that vocabulary or sentence structure and whatnot. Of course, it's spread out over lots and lots of different sentences. It's not just one sentence. So we always tell people, if one sentence trips you up, don't worry about it. Go on to the next sentence. It's not the end of the world. You're going to get more progress by practicing 100 or 1,000 sentences with similar patterns rather than one sentence that you can never get right. With your martial arts background, it's something, you know, you practice that kick 1,000 times. And in this case, it's like you're practicing that one kick, but 1,000 times, but with people coming at you at different directions.
Exactly.
You
know,
you're practicing on how to deliver that kick under 1,000 different situations. And so that's kind of what we're doing here.
Yeah, it's really cool. I just played around a bit with it. Certainly not long enough to really, really fully understand how it all goes together. But it definitely does take a change in perspective and a change in expectation if people are used to studying just vocabulary flashcards or going through a textbook or, you know, always wanting to know a word for word translation, for example.
Yeah. And here's the other thing is that we have a really big fall off rate from new users. Like they'll get onto the site on the first day and then they'll leave and they'll never come back. Mm-hmm. The problem is that they're not giving it a chance.
Right.
You know, you can't get results. It's like going to the gym for a trial on the very first day and you tell your coach, you say, "Hey dude, give me some muscles." And he's like, "Okay, right. Well, let's go do this one exercise and I'll show you how we're going to do it." And then an hour later, you look at the coach, you know, this trainer, and you say, "Dude, where are my muscles, man?
Yeah.
You suck. Yeah. I'm leaving." You know, it's not like that. You know, Glossika is a gym, and you have to show up every day, but it goes with you. It's in your phone. You can it goes with you. So you gotta show up and do it every day, and your muscles will appear. I mean, the biggest complaint, you know, the only complaint that I would say is that people aren't getting results because they just haven't used it, you know?
Yeah.
But the people that are using it, they're going up to tens of thousands of reps. They're getting massive results. And literally, the guys who walk around with big muscles in the gym, it's because they show up and they do it all the time. Mm-hmm. They didn't appear magically, you know?
My wife and I always joke because we both have studied nutrition. In fact, that's how we met. We'll eat a salad and be like, "Where's my six pack?" I ate a salad. Where's my, why don't I have a six pack yet?
Yeah.
Same thing.
And so people will ask me, hey, Mike, I'm just not getting fluent with this. Mm. And I go in and look at the reps.
Right.
And I look and I say, dude, you've only done like 8,000 reps of this language. What do you mean you're not fluent? Of course you're not fluent. 8,000 reps is like a two-year-old at 6 months. You know, how much can a two-year-old at 6 months say?
5 words.
You know, it's got a working vocabulary of like 30 words, you know?
Right.
So, but a two-year-old, when he reaches the third birthday, that kid's already got like 20,000 reps. You know, he's saying a lot of stuff. He's,
right.
And by the next year, by the time the kid's 5 years old, that kid's got, you know, 200,000 reps. Don't tell me you're not fluent at 8,000 reps. Give me a break.
Right.
It's like going to the gym 8 times. Where's my muscles, man?
Yeah.
You got to do 30,000 reps, bro.
Right.
You got to keep going.
Yeah, I think an important tip for using something like this, or really anything in language learning, is focus more on the habit of the habit earlier on.
Yeah.
You know, it's I don't care how many words you're going to learn a day. I don't care how many Chinese characters you're going to study a day. It's, did you learn any every single day for a week, for a month, for a year? Like, show up.
If you have learned this language before, you're going to get massive results on Glossika really fast because you already know what's going on with the language. Mm-hmm. So you can do 7 days of Glossika and you're just going to feel like, holy cow, man, I just learned a lot. Like this language is coming back to me.
Yeah.
Like I'm starting to remember how to speak this language I had in high school or something. That the language you learned in high school or as a kid, this is going to boost your ability so fast, so well. It really works because you don't have to really overthink the grammar. You already know, you know, what's going on with vocabulary and grammar kind of in the background. Mm-hmm. But we focus on just bringing it out to the front. You know, this is how you communicate.
Right.
So it works really well for those people. But if you're starting from scratch, you need some strategies in place. But that's a different story.
So, well, just real quick then, what would you recommend if somebody is like a complete absolute beginner in a language?
Well, those are things that we're trying to solve for all of our users right now. So we're building a whole new set of tools for everybody in that respect. So the thing is like, oh, you might need some grammar reference. You need some little bit of help with understanding the structure. Where's the verb? Where's the noun in the sentence? Mm-hmm. I would say that the number one thing is just recognizing the parts of speech. What's a noun look like? What's a verb look like? Any new sentence you come across, you're learning a new language. That's what you got to figure out. You know, where's the verb? Show me where the verb is. And if you don't know where the verb is, then you don't feel that action on that word, then you're not going to feel the sentence. You're not going to feel, it's just going to be a bunch of noise.
Right.
You know, you can't let every sentence just sound like noise. You have to feel the verb.
So not that there's any perfect tool, but are there other resources then or other apps or websites that you think would complement really well in the beginning then to help with that?
Yeah, I mean, just having a real quick at the grammar, like what does a verb conjugation look like? Mm-hmm. What do the noun declensions look like? That can help immensely. If it's
where
a language
do you go
like
for
Japanese,
that? Just like Wikipedia or what's your, what's
yeah,
your
I mean,
go-to?
Like a lot of us, even like me and yourself, you've written like basic guides to like Japanese, you know, here's your particles in Japanese. This is what the ni means, the wa and the ga and the o and the, you know, all of those things. Learn those basic things. The to and the te, how you connect a te to a verb, you know, all these things, or having the E ending on the verbs, you can add more stuff onto them. And that's one of my big things is what people need to learn is like how to connect two verbs together. That works kind of a little bit uniquely in a lot of languages, but you'll find that some concepts are universal, like that E in Japanese is also an E in Korean at the end of a verb that connects to another verb. Or you have that.
That's because Korean and Japanese are related, but don't tell any Japanese or Korean people that they'll get mad at us.
We don't want to
admit it.
Somebody off. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, come on. Look at the grammar. Come on now.
I've looked at a lot of languages over the past 10 years, and I've learned a lot of things, but the funny thing, you know, speaking of linguists, if you guys have never heard of this, there's a linguist called Chomsky, and he came up with a nonsense sentence called colorless green ideas sleep furiously.
Yes.
So one thing that's always bothered me is that how can somebody come up with a sentence like that and call that real language? Because I don't think that you can actually call that a real sentence or a real language because it's nonsense. Mm-hmm. So even though the grammar works in that sentence, I don't think that it's something that anybody would possibly come up with in their life. That's like me saying, I don't know, come up with something like completely random right now, like the frog promised from the pillow's queen. I just put like the wrong preposition in there, mm-hmm. put the wrong order of of genitive case or whatever. But that's kind of the idea is like you have to think really hard to come up with a nonsense sentence. You know what I mean?
Well, just look at any legal contract and there's plenty of them.
So I've read up on minimalist grammar, universal grammar, mm-hmm. optimality theory, and I found that all of these grammars that are discussed in linguistics, they kind of have these weak points. And what I was trying to come up with was something to build all of our algorithms at Glossika off of, which is something that was built at a deep level syntax and a deep level semantics, a linking between them. And I found that using roles instead of subjects and objects on marking and tagging everything in our sentences, mm-hmm. Really seems to work. And it actually prevents sentences like colorless green ideas sleeping fiercely from appearing. They're just not possible under this framework. And that's what I love about it. The role and reference grammar, it really works so well across all languages. The thing is with universal grammar, optimality theory and all these others is that there's so much compensation for all of the things that can go haywire in languages and just none of that in role and reference grammar. Everything is a role and everything is what it is. So the thing is with Glossika is that everything that's tagged in our database, you can switch up the word order in our tagging system as much as you want. In fact, there is no word order in our grammar explanation. And that's what I love about it, is that there is no core of the sentence. There is no outside core. There's no adjuncts. Our system, I think it's even an improvement on role and reference grammar, because role and reference grammar uses adjuncts as well. But we work with the verb as the core of everything. And then it's basically like a computer language. So mm-hmm. every verb has arguments. And how many arguments is called its valency. This is true in linguistics. You can look it up. So every verb has a number of valencies. For example, if I say give will have a valency of 3. I give you a book. So I, you, and book are different roles. I is the agent. You is the benefactor or beneficiary. And the book is the theme. The theme is past. It was no action acted upon it. So, yeah, that's an example of a valency 3 verb. A valency 0 verb is something like it's raining. Mm-hmm. And it is just something added in English just to make the sentence work. Like you mentioned earlier, it's a zero subject verb.
Right.
But that's not always true in every language. Like a lot of languages just use the word fall, like in Russian, mm-hmm. Japanese too, and Chinese
yep.
too.
Yep.
So I would say that if you look at languages like this, I have a really good example about what can trip up students as well is just terminology. And this will work for students learning French and Spanish and German as well. You might have some people out there that are learning Slavic languages. It'll help them as well. The thing is that this whole idea of tense, like we don't actually encode for tense in our grammar. The reason is because it's not really a universal among languages. Now, tense is important, but there's actually so much that's already encoded in the verb that tense is actually kind of redundant. So if I say, I went to school yesterday, why do I have to say went when I already said yesterday?
Right. You know? Right.
If I say, I went to school, you're just saying a very ambiguous sentence. I have gone to school. You change that into present perfect. You're just saying that you've completed the action, which is great, you know, but that's already encoded in the verb. So most languages, they encode for aspect, and that means whether the action was completed or not. So when you're learning a language like Spanish and you come across this word called perfect and imperfect, these concepts are basically combining both tense and aspect in them. And so when you're learning Slavic languages, they have something called imperfective and perfective. But the difference between them is that perfective has nothing to do with tense. So, for example, I can say, I go to work Monday to Friday. And in this sentence, I'm just stating a fact that this is something that I regularly do.
Right.
Habitual. I didn't finish any action. So if you translate this into a Slavic language, you're going to just unambiguously use the imperfective because it's an iterative verb of motion. So if you say, I used to go to work Monday to Friday, now you're just using the same verb in the past tense. But you see, English has to have a workaround. It has to add in all these other verbs, like I used to. If you say, I just got back from work, this has to be perfective in those languages because you just finished the action. And so what's great is that you can map these perfectly with other tenseless languages, like Chinese doesn't have tense as well. Mm-hmm. If you add the Chinese word hui with a verb, and I know this sound might actually sound a little bit offensive to any Russian speakers because hui is actually a bad word in Russian, but it means you're certainly going to do something. So right. If I say, I'm going to go, I'm going to say, well, hui chu.
Yeah.
I'm going to go, true. And yeah. It's kind of like a future tense.
Right.
So you can translate it as a future tense, but it's actually, you're certainly going to do it. But it's actually an aspect that you intend to undertake that action. And that Chinese hui translates directly into Russian with all this complex grammar as a perfective verb in the present tense. But every Russian student learns that a perfective verb in the present tense actually means the future tense. And they're really confused by that. They're like, I don't understand why. Mm-hmm. Why is that the future tense? Why is a perfective verb in the present tense a future tense? Mm-hmm. They don't understand. But the great thing is that if you just learn that all of these labels on things, they might be confusing. But the thing is, like, if you're going to do something, it's perfective in Russian. It probably sounds a little bit confusing, but I guess you could go back and listen to this again.
Yeah, and I think the big takeaway is that knowing what something is not nearly as important as knowing, is this right or wrong? Is this what a native speaker would say? And the only way to know that is to hear it and hear it and hear it and say it and say it and say it in context, which is exactly what I think Glasska does really well from what I can tell. So,
yeah, thank you very much.
So other than Glasska, obviously, what is like a language-related book or tool or resources that you most give as a gift or recommend to people?
Yeah, I haven't really thought about that all that much, but I think that most of the time, most of the recommendations that I give people is just to get stories and novels in the language that they're learning. For example, there's a lot of resources online that you can actually get. So, for example, I've read The 1001 Arabian Nights. It's a classic, you know. But what's great about the story is that there's just so much stuff about, like, there's so many, like, human, the whole realm of human emotions in there. Like, there's greed and theft and, you know the stories. There's, like, Alibaba and the 40, and, you know, what the guys are thinking and what they're doing and all these actions. And so it's a really good basis to kind of read these stories in another language. So I'm reading them right now in Russian. But I've also read stories like Little Prince. I've read that in Georgian. I've read it in Cambodian. I've read that in a few languages. I actually, despite not knowing French, I do have some novels written in French, and I occasionally look at those. I have a lot of novels written in Polish and Russian and German, and so I try to keep up. I don't speak these languages regularly. I don't hear them regularly, but I try to read as much as I can. And then I do get notifications on, like, I can easily switch my cell phone to like a Russian interface, and then I'll get all my news feed in Russian. It'll just come up with all the local news in Russia happening right now, and it kind of remembers your settings. Like, it knows that I'm not interested in like petty crimes, and I'm not really interested in politics all that much. So it'll show me like what's happening in the startup space, entrepreneurial stuff, all the stuff that I follow usually. But it'll be Russian stuff, and I'll change my phone settings to German, and I'll get all the same news in Germany and related news and what's going on. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, that's a huge hack you can do now. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I don't know what you guys use. I don't know how the Apple, how the iPhone works. I'm on a Pixel. So it's super easy. I just go into languages. I pull the language up to the top of the list, and suddenly my whole system changes into Russian or German or Chinese. And then Google remembers what I'd like to read about. And if I don't like it, I just tell it, remove this from my likes.
Right.
And it'll remember it. It's really great. So
yeah, no, Apple's the same. It's a few seconds and you have, you know, immersion in your pocket. It's absolutely phenomenal.
I assume they're all doing it. So, you know, no matter what system you're on and device,
And people can change websites too. You know, individually you can change Facebook, you can change you know, Google websites into other languages too, which is, I think, useful.
Yeah, creating a sort of a daily immersion for yourself, you know, the daily life, daily activities, and immerse yourself. Now, it's probably scary at first, you know, like you're going to turn your whole interface into Cyrillic script. Like, I can't read anything yet. You know, that's intimidating for people. You know, if you're learning Arabic, now it's all squiggly and all the in the other direction, and that can be really intimidating. And you're like, I don't know any of the buttons, or I don't know what to press anymore. So I would say that at least you recognize the word for language. You can go back and get your settings back.
Yeah,
at least that.
I recommend it people, you know, probably intermediate level or above, and then make sure you already know how to use your phone well. And know how to undo what you just did. Exactly.
It can be intimidating.
Yeah.
I've turned my phone settings into like Persian and Arabic and Tamil, only to be very frustrated and just like, oh, wait a minute.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I'm getting way in over my head right now. I'm going to go back.
Yeah. It definitely depends. Like, I mean, I do it every so often. I'll put it back in Japanese to refresh. And then I just started learning German. I'm not going to switch it to German yet because I'm not there. But at some point.
Yeah. If you want to play a trick on a friend who's not a language learner, turn their phone, go into their phone settings and turn it into Tamil.
There you go.
Tamil is a language spoken in southern India. It's like impossible to read. So play a trick on them.
Yeah.
But you better know how to get it back.
Right. Linguistic April Fools. Your friend's
gonna unfriend you really fast.
My other favorite trick along these lines is if you work with, if you're an American who works with like somebody who speaks British English, go in and change the spell check settings to American English, and they'll get little red squiggles underneath, you know, color with a U or I think that's it's a good one.
I think that they're already oppressed too much.
Yeah.
The British, because all of these big sites like Google and whatnot, they're already impose American spellings on so many people.
You should do it
to your American friends.
There
impose
you go.
The British spellings on them. You know, the funny thing is, like, when I was in school as a kid, I learned all of my spelling in British style. So
interesting.
International school. So and I went to British school for a while. So most of my foundational years learning how to read and write was in the British system. So I've always been in a complete mess my whole life. How am I supposed to write this word? Like, who's my audience?
Yeah.
Now I have to use this, like, keep everything in one system or the other.
Right. Yeah. Which can be tricky too. If you're teaching English, for example, in Taiwan, I mean, they, depending on your students, if they work for a company, for example, that works with people of the States, then, you know, they'll want to learn American standards. But if they're working with people from, you know, UK, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, whatever, I mean, they have to learn other spelling conventions and terminology. Yeah, it can be a mess. But like you said, English sucks. So, you know, why bother? We should just all learn Mandarin and Tamil. And
English is great because everything is published in English. You have to have access to knowledge and resources, and, you know, like, knowing English has that advantage, and it gives you access to this being tremendously successful in life, everything, everywhere you want to go in the world. But don't let that cloud your vision as to language diversity is there for a reason. You know, something that Jared Diamond says in his books is that a lot of people argue for getting rid of all these other languages. Like, people say, well, we only really need like a maximum of 5 or 10 languages in the world. So let the other 7,000 of them die off, you know. Mm-hmm. But the argument behind this is that, okay, well, if you just want to go for the biggest language, then I'm going to impose Chinese Mandarin on all of you.
Right.
Now, all of you have to start, you know, no broadcast in the United States is allowed to continue in English. Now, how would you feel about that?
Right.
I think people would be pretty pissed off. So the next thing is that if we look at the Navajos, for example, they're perfectly fine speaking English, but they want to keep their language because it's part of their identity. And they feel – and language is a source of pride. It's a source of it's also, you know, here's the cultural connection is that it gives them a way to discuss their culture in their own fashion, with their own words. And it's something very Sometimes languages do have words that are specific for that specific, you know, culture. It's just like me speaking the Thao language, an indigenous language, and wishing somebody. It's like saying in Russian, "na zdorovye," like this is to your health. But it's like a common greeting in Thao is just "pyakalinkin," which means I wish good health upon you. And it's something you exchange during the New Year's festivities and other holidays, "pyakalinkin." Or maybe somebody you haven't seen in a long time. But this goes a long way with creating that heart-to-heart connection with people, because even if they don't speak Thao, this indigenous language, when they hear "pyakalinkin" and they're from that village, they recognize it. They're like, "Oh, wow, that's so awesome that you just said that. That's really special." You know, language gives communities that very special connection. And so when you have a hegemonistic language like either Mandarin or English, you lose that hometown connection. It's like eating McDonald's versus having your home, your grandma's home cooking.
Right.
You know, you can go back to your hometown and eat McDonald's if you want, but who wants to, right?
Right.
You want to have that really delicious hometown cooking. That's what languages have, that sight and sound and smell of that local flavor. And it's just something amazing. And it brings back memories and it brings back a flood of emotions. And that's why we want to keep languages alive. When a community loses their language, it's devastating, you know.
Yeah. But we also have to, you know, realize that they're alive and they're constantly changing too. So when people say, you know, we need to quote unquote preserve a language, you know, I always respond with, well, which form of it? The one right now or the one in 100 years from now? You know, it's always changing. Yeah. And I think another important part of at least the theory is, you know, languages largely probably evolved not just to communicate, but also to indicate in-group and out-group. So you'd know, okay, who's from my tribe, who we can share resources with, and who is obviously not from our, you know, immediate community, who might be a threat. Because you can't fake a language unless you've been learning it forever and ever. So, and even if you have been learning it, go ahead.
Sometimes it's kind of rude to speak somebody else's language as well. So you have to be kind of careful with the social dynamics there. Especially, you don't want to be switching to like slang and stuff like that. I think even in America, you know, Americans are very... very focused on this in-group and out-group thing, but I think this is a universal around the world. And so if you start speaking like another group of people that you might know, like you might know a group of people in the US and they, you know, you have all these labels for people, like you have the nerds and the geeks and the jocks and all these other people. But if you start speaking like them and you're not really one of them, you're just going to look silly, you know?
Yeah.
Unless you always hang out with them and then you start acquiring the way they speak, then you're part of the in crowd. But if you just show up in a foreign country trying to speak their language, you're going to get a lot of puzzling looks and stuff. But you have to let it warm up. You know, if you show up at a tribe and you say, "Hey, dude, I want to just like, oh, pyakalinkin everywhere," and they don't know who you are, they're just going to be like, "Dude, get lost."
Yeah.
You have to kind of approach it with a little bit of tact and
humility.
Do it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, cool, man. Any other final last words or parting tips for new learners of languages?
Yeah, just don't give up. You know, don't tell me you're fluent when you only got less than 10,000 reps. you got to keep showing up and doing your reps every day. We hope we can shorten that, make it less work, you know, but I think that technology will change and it will help us improve. But seriously, people argue that there's no point in learning a language anymore, but to tell you the truth, you can use these automatic translators and stuff. They're great to get you out of tricky situations, but having that language on the tip of your tongue that you can just spit it out anytime you want, anywhere, it's, you know, having it in your biology rather than something you have to have a battery to run internet to run is just a great feeling. It's just an amazing feeling. It's always there with you, and it becomes part of you, part of your existence, part of your identity. Is that something that you want? Is that, you know, do you want to experience the feeling of being bilingual, of switching back and forth between any language, between two languages, that you know how to handle really well. That feeling will allow you to look at the world. It expands your mind, allow you to look at the world differently, how to better problem solve, because you can see not just subjects and objects, but also agents and patients. So, you know, how everything interacts in the world differently. It's a really, really, really good thing. It should be part of our fundamental education for everybody in the formative years. And if you didn't get it, then get on it.
Just not too late.
It doesn't have to be a lifelong pursuit. You know, mm-hmm. Put 6 months to a year into it. Make 2019 your year of, I'm going to master this language as much as I can. And, you know, even if you get to an A2 or a low B1 level, it doesn't matter. Put your full effort in and don't stop until you've done, you know, you can use John's materials. You can use my program, Glossika, and do your reps. You can count your reps. Do 50,000 reps. You know, just keep trucking. Go through it. Use John's materials. Go through everything. Read every word he's written, everything he's done, and start, you know, putting things into practice. So language is not knowledge. It's not how many grammar tables you learned or, you know, can you write down the whole table of declensions from your head or conjugations from your head? That's not the point. Mm-hmm. The point is, to tell you the truth, like those declension and conjugation tables, there's a big chunk of those tables that are used less than 1% of the time. It's so funny because in Polish they have like this declension table for the word like door, right?
Yeah.
Here's the singular and the plural for door. The thing is that the Polish people, they never use the singular word for mm-hmm. door ever. Hmm. It just never happens. There is no singular word for the door, but you can find it in the declension table. You'd be wasting your time memorizing them all.
Right.
And you'd be wasting your time memorizing most of them because most of them are never even used because the door is only used in one way. So seriously, like, stop memorizing that stuff. You know, all of this grammar, there's only like 1% of it is actually used in the highest frequency.
Yep.
And the rest of it shows up in all other words.
Plus,
so you'd be saving a lot of time.
Yeah. I was going to say, plus you're wasting your time because looking at something in a grammar table with your eyeballs on a screen or piece of paper has almost nothing to do with being able to use it in person in real time. Those are like completely different skills. Yeah.
I remember what I said in the beginning about Chinese is that people make shortcuts in their pronunciation. This is true in every language. So the allophones and learning how to say, you know, a lot of those conjugations and stuff, they're going to be shortened a little bit. I mean, one extreme example is Finnish. Finnish has really long words, but people don't talk like that. Mm-hmm. Everything is shortened into like really, really short words when people speak Finnish. So just one extreme example, but so many languages are, I mean, it's basically the human experience. The human experience is the same. We all take the shortcuts and we all do the same thing and we all find easier ways to get our point across faster and easier. So
it's a cool thing.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, man. I really enjoyed chatting with you again, and I hope to get my butt back to Taiwan one of these days for a visit. It's been too long.
Yeah, it'd be good to see you.
You too, man. All right, thanks for chatting with me today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Mike Campbell of Glossika. For show notes, go to languagemastery.com/show. And if you enjoyed what you heard, I'd greatly appreciate a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, that's all for this week. We'll see you again next Friday.